Early that day, August 7th, the Japanese radio broadcast for the first time a succinct announcement that very few, if any, of the people most concerned with its content, the survivors in Hiroshima, happened to hear.
Hiroshima suffered considerable damage as the result of an attack by a few B-29s. It is believed that a new type of bomb was used. The details are being investigated.
Nor is it probable that any of the survivors happened to be tuned in on the shortwave rebroadcast of an extraordinary announcement by the President of the United States, which identified the new bomb as atomic.
That bomb had more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. It had more than 2,000 times the blast power of the British Grand Slam, which is the largest bomb ever yet used in the history of warfare.
Those victims who were able to worry at all about what had happened thought of it and discussed it in more primitive, childish terms.
Gasoline sprinkled from an airplane,
or some
maybe.
Combustible gas.
Or a big cluster of incendiaries.
Or the work of
parachutists. Mm.
But even if they had known the truth, most of them were too busy or too weary or too badly hurt to care that they were the objects of the first great experiment in the use of atomic power, which, as the voices on the shortwave shouted,
no country except the United States, with its industrial know-how, its willingness to throw $2 billion into an important wartime gamble, could possibly have developed it.
Mr. Tanimoto was still angry at doctors. He decided that he would personally bring one to Asano Park, by the scruff of the neck if necessary. He walked to the East Parade Ground. Since this had long before been designated as an evacuation area, he thought he would find an aid station there. He did find one, operated by an Army medical unit. But he also saw that its doctors were hopelessly overburdened, with thousands of patients sprawled among corpses across the field in front of it. Nevertheless, he went up to one of the Army doctors and said as reproachfully as he could, "Why have you not come to Asano Park? You are badly needed there." Without even looking up from his work, the doctor said in a tired voice,
"This is my station.
But there are many dying on the riverbank over there."
"The first duty is to take care of the slightly wounded."
"Why, when there are many who are heavily wounded on the riverbank?" The doctor moved to another patient.
"In an emergency like this, the first task is to help as many as possible, to save as many lives as possible. There is no hope for the heavily wounded. They will die. We can't bother with them."
"Oh, well, that may be right from a medical standpoint."
The morning, again, was hot. Father Kleinsorger went to fetch water for the wounded in a bottle and a teapot he had borrowed. He had heard that it was possible to get fresh tap water outside Asano Park. Outside the gate of the park, Father Kleinsorger found a faucet that still worked, part of the plumbing of a vanished house, and he filled his vessels and returned. When he had given the wounded the water, he made a second trip. On his way back with the water, he got lost on a detour around a fallen tree, and as he looked for his way through the woods, he heard a voice ask from the underbrush,
"Have you anything to drink?"
He saw a uniform. Thinking there was just one soldier, he approached with the water. When he had penetrated the bushes, he saw there were about 20 men, and they were all in exactly the same nightmarish state. Their faces were wholly burned. Their eye sockets were hollow. The fluid from their melted eyes had run down their cheeks. They must have had their faces upturned when the bomb went off. Perhaps they were anti-aircraft personnel. Their mouths were mere swollen, pus-covered wounds, which they could not bear to stretch enough to admit the spout of the teapot. So Father Kleinsorger got a large piece of grass and drew out the stem so as to make a straw, and gave them all water to drink that way. One of them said,
"I can't see anything."
Father Kleinsorger answered as cheerfully as he could, "There's a doctor at the entrance to the park. He's busy now, but he'll come soon and fix your eyes, I hope."
It was difficult for all the children in the park to sustain the sense of tragedy. Toshio Nakamura, got quite excited when he saw his friend, Seichi Sato, riding up the river in a boat with his family. And he ran to the bank and waved and shouted,
Sato! Sato!
Who's that?
Nakamura!
Hello, Toshio!
Are you all safe?
Yes. What about you?
Yes, we're all right. My sisters are vomiting. But I'm fine.
Altogether, Miss Sasaki was left 2 days and two nights under the piece of propped-up roofing with her crushed leg and her two unpleasant comrades. Her leg became discolored, swollen, and putrid. All that time, she went without food and water. Later, some men picked her up and carried her quite a distance to a truck. For about an hour, the truck moved over a bumpy road, and Miss Sasaki, who had become convinced that she was dulled to pain, discovered that she was not. The men lifted her out at a relief station where two army doctors looked at her. The moment one of them touched her wound, she fainted. She came to in time to hear them discuss whether or not to cut off her leg. One said there was gas gangrene in the lips of the wound and predicted she would die unless they amputated. And the other said that was too bad because they had no equipment with which to do the job. She fainted again. When she recovered consciousness, she was being carried somewhere on a stretcher. She was put aboard a launch which went to the nearby island of Ninoshima, and she was taken to a military hospital there. Another doctor examined her and said that she did not have gas gangrene, though she did have a fairly ugly compound fracture. He said quite coldly that he was sorry, but this was a hospital for operative surgical cases only, and because she had no gangrene, she would have to return to Hiroshima that night. But then the doctor took her temperature, and what he saw on the thermometer made him decide to let her stay.
At the Red Cross Hospital, Dr. Sasaki worked for 3 straight days with only 1 hour sleep. On the second day, he began to sew up the worst cuts, and right through the following night and all the next day, he stitched. Many of the wounds were festered. Fortunately, someone had found intact a supply of narukopon, a Japanese sedative, and he gave it to many who were in pain. Word went around among the staff that there must have been something peculiar about the great bomb, because on the second day, the vice chief of the hospital went down in the basement to the vault where the X-ray plates were stored and found the whole stock exposed as they lay. In the afternoon of the third day, exhausted from his foul tailoring, Dr. Sasaki became obsessed with the idea that his mother thought he was dead. He got permission to go to Mukaihara. He reached home late in the evening. His mother said she had known he was right all along. A wounded nurse had stopped by to tell her. He went to bed and slept for 17 hours.
On August 9th, Father Kleinsorger was still tired. The rector looked at his cuts and said they were not even worth dressing. And if Father Kleinsorger kept them clean, they would heal in 3 or 4 days. Father Kleinsorger felt uneasy. He could not yet comprehend what he had been through.
At 11:02 on the morning of August 9th, the second atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. It was several days before the survivors of Hiroshima knew they had company because the Japanese radio and newspapers were being extremely cautious on the subject of the strange weapon.
On August 9th, Mr. Tanimoto was still working in the park. Whatever he did in the park, he felt he was being watched by the 20-year-old girl, Mrs. Kamai, his former neighbor whom he had seen on the day the bomb exploded with her dead baby daughter in her arms. She kept the small corpse in her arms for 4 days, even though it began smelling bad on the second day. Once Mr. Tanimoto sat with her for a while, and she told him that the bomb had buried her under their house with the baby strapped to her back, and that when she had dug herself free, she had discovered that the baby was choking its mouth full of dirt. With her little finger, she had carefully cleaned out the infant's mouth, and for a time the child had breathed normally and seemed all right. Then suddenly, it had died. Every time she saw Mr. Tanimoto, she asked whether he had found her husband. Once he tried to suggest that perhaps it was time to cremate the baby, but Mrs. Kamai only held it tighter. He began to keep away from her, but whenever he looked at her, She was staring at him, and her eyes asked the same question. He tried to escape her glance by keeping his back turned to her as much as possible.
At the exquisite chapel of the novitiate, the Nakamuras were provided with a blanket and a mosquito net. On August 10th, a friend, Mrs. Osaka, came to see them and told them that her son, Hideo, had been burned alive in the factory where he worked. This Hideo had been a kind of hero to Toshio, who had often gone to the plant to watch him run his machine. That night, Toshio woke up screaming. He had dreamed that he had seen Mrs. Osaka coming out of an opening in the ground with her family, and then he saw Hideo at his machine, a big one with a revolving belt, and he himself was standing beside Hideo. And for some reason, this was terrifying.
After 5 days of ministering to the wounded in the park, Mr. Tanimoto returned to his parsonage and dug around in the ruins. While he was at work, a Miss Tanaka came and said that her father had been asking for him. Mr. Tanimoto had reason to hate her father, for though he had made a great show of his charity, was notoriously selfish and cruel, and who, just a few days before the bombing, had said openly to several people that Mr. Tanimoto was a spy for the Americans. Several times he had derided Christianity and called it un-Japanese. Mr. Tanaka had received serious flash burns, but he was able to walk home. He expected all the doctors of Hiroshima to come to him because he was so rich and so famous for giving his money away. None of them came. Now he was very weak and knew he was going to die. He was willing to be comforted by any religion. Mr. Tanimoto went to help him. He descended into the tomb-like shelter, and when his eyes were adjusted to the darkness, saw Mr. Tanaka, his face and arms puffed up and covered with pus and blood, and his eyes swollen shut. The old man smelled very bad, and he moaned constantly. He seemed to recognize Mr. Tanimoto's voice. Standing at the shelter stairway to get light, Mr. Tanimoto read loudly from a Japanese language pocket Bible. "For 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday, when it is past, and as a watch in the night. Thou carriest the children of men away as with a flood. They are as asleep. In the morning they are like grass which groweth up. In the morning it flourisheth and groweth up. In the evening it is cut down and withereth. For we are consumed by thine anger, and by thy wrath are we troubled." Mr. Tanaka died as Mr. Tanimoto read the psalm.
On August 11th, Miss Sasaki was put on a large ship. She was taken ashore at Hatsukaichi and put in the Goddess of Mercy Primary School, which had been turned into a hospital. She lay there for several days before a specialist on fractures came from Kobe. By then, her leg was red and swollen up to her hip. The doctor decided he could not set the brakes. He made an incision and put in a rubber pipe to drain off the putrescence.
About a week after the bomb dropped, a vague, incomprehensible rumor reached Hiroshima that the city had been destroyed by the energy released when atoms were somehow split in two. The weapon was referred to in this word-of-mouth report as Genshi Bakudan, the root characters of which can be translated as original child bomb.
A comparative orderliness, at least, began to be established at the Red Cross Hospital. Dr. Sasaki, back from his rest, undertook to classify his patients. The staff gradually swept up the debris. Best of all, the nurses and attendants started to remove the corpses. Disposal of the dead by decent cremation and enshrinement is a greater moral responsibility to the Japanese than adequate care of the living. Relatives identified most of the first day's dead in and around the hospital. Beginning on the second day, whenever a patient appeared to be moribund, a piece of paper with his name on it was fastened to his clothing. The corpse detail carried the bodies to a clearing outside, placed them on piles of wood from ruined houses, burned them, put some of the ashes in envelopes intended for exposed X-ray plates, marked the envelopes with the names of the deceased, and piled them neatly and respectfully in stacks in the main office. In a few days, the envelopes filled one whole side of the impromptu shrine.
On the morning of August 15th, the dull, dispirited voice of Hirohito, the Emperor Tenno, was speaking for the first time in history over the radio.
After pondering deeply the general trends of the world and the actual condition obtaining in our empire today, we have decided to effect a settlement of present situation by resorting to an extraordinary measure.
Mrs. Nakamura had gone into the city again to dig up some rice she had buried in her neighborhood association air raid shelter. She got it and started back to Kabe. On the electric car, quite by chance, she ran into her younger sister, who had not been in Hiroshima the day of the bombing.
Have you heard the news?
What news?
The war is over.
Don't say such a foolish thing, sister.
But I heard it over the radio myself.
It was the Emperor's voice.
Oh. In that case, she needed nothing more to make her give up thinking, in spite of the atomic bomb, that Japan still had a chance to win the war.
Sometime later, in a letter to an American, Mr. Tanimoto described the events of that morning.
At the time of the post-war, the marvelous thing in our history happened. Our emperor broadcasted his own voice through radio directly to us common people of Japan. August 15th, we were told that some news of great importance could be heard and all of us should hear it. So I went to Hiroshima Railway Station. There sat a loudspeaker in the ruins of the station. Many civilians, all of them were in bondage, some being held by shoulder of their daughters, some sustaining their injured feet by sticks. They listened to the broadcast, and when they came to realize the fact that it was the Emperor, they cried with full tears in their eyes.
What a wonderful blessing it is that Tenno himself call on us and we can hear his own voice in person. We are thoroughly satisfied in such a great sacrifice.
When they came to know the war was ended, that is, Japan was defeated, they, of course, were deeply disappointed, but followed after their emperor's commandment in calm spirit, making wholehearted sacrifice for the everlasting peace of the world. And Japan started her new way.
You are listening to John Hersey's Hiroshima, a Pacifica Radio Archive special program commemorating the 58th anniversary of the bombing of the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We'll be back in just a moment.
Chapter 4. Panic Grass and Fever Few.
On August 18th, 12 days after the bomb burst, Father Kleinsorge set out on foot for Hiroshima from the novitiate with his papier-mâché suitcase in his hand. He had begun to think that this bag in which he kept his valuables had a talismanic quality because of the way he had found it after the explosion, standing, handle side up, in the doorway of his room, while the desk under which he had previously hidden it was in splinters all over the floor. Now he was using it to carry the yen belonging to the Society of Jesus to the Hiroshima branch of the Yokohama Specie Bank, already reopened in its half-ruined building. By now he was accustomed to the terrible scene through which he walked on his way into the city, but Father Kleinsorge was oppressed by the thought that all the damage he saw had been done in one instant by one bomb. He walked to the Yokohama Bank, which was doing business in a temporary wooden stall on the ground floor of its building, deposited the money, went by the mission compound just to have another look at the wreckage, and then started back to the novitiate. About halfway there, he began to have peculiar sensations. The more or less magical suitcase, now empty, suddenly seemed terribly heavy. His knees grew weak. He felt excruciatingly tired. With a considerable expenditure of spirit, he managed to reach the novitiate. A couple of days later, while attempting to say Mass, he had an onset of faintness and, even after three attempts, was unable to go through with the service. And the next morning, the rector, who had examined Father Kleinsorge's apparently negligible but unhealed cuts daily, asked in surprise,
"What have you done with your wounds?"
They had suddenly opened wider and were swollen and inflamed.
As she dressed on the morning of August 20th, in the home of her sister-in-law in Kabe, not far from Nagatsuka, Mrs. Nakamura, who had suffered no cuts or burns at all, though she had been rather nauseated all through the week she and her children had spent as guests of Father Kleinsorge and the other Catholics at the novitiate, began fixing her hair, and noticed, after one stroke, that her comb carried with it a whole handful of hair. The second time, the same thing happened. So she stopped combing at once. But in the next 3 or 4 days, her hair began falling out of its own accord, until she was quite bald. She began living indoors, practically in hiding. On August 26th, both she and her younger daughter, Mieko, woke up feeling extremely weak and tired, and they stayed on their bedrolls. Her son and other daughter, who had shared every experience with her during and after the bombing, felt fine.
At about the same time, Mr. Tanimoto fell suddenly ill, with a general malaise, weariness, and feverishness. And he too took to his bedroll on the floor of the half-wrecked house of a friend in the suburb of Ushida.
These four did not realize it, but they were coming down with a strange, capricious disease, which came later to be known as radiation sickness.
Miss Sasaki lay in steady pain in the Goddess of Mercy Primary School at Hatsukaichi. Because her leg did not improve but swelled more and more, the doctors bound it with crude splints and took her by car on September 9th to the Red Cross Hospital in Hiroshima. This was the first chance she had had to look at the ruins of Hiroshima. Even though the wreckage had been described to her, and though she was still in pain, the sight horrified and amazed her. And there was something she noticed about it that particularly gave her the creeps. Over everything, up through the wreckage of the city, in gutters, along the riverbanks, tangled among tiles and tin roofing, climbing on charred tree trunks, was a blanket of fresh, vivid, lush, optimistic green. The verdancy rose even from the foundations of ruined houses. Weeds already hid the ashes, and wildflowers were in bloom among the city's bones. The bomb had not only left the underground organs of plants intact, it had stimulated them. Everywhere were bluets and Spanish bayonets, goosefoot, morning glories and daylilies, the hairy-fruited bean, purslane and clotbur and sesame and panic grass and feverfew. Especially in a circle at the center, sickle senna grew in extraordinary regeneration, not only standing among the charred remnants of the same plant, but pushing up in new places, among bricks and through cracks in the asphalt. It actually seemed as if a load of sickle senna seed had been dropped along with the bomb. At the Red Cross Hospital, Miss Sasaki was put under the care of Dr. Sasaki.
Since Miss Sasaki was a woman and was so sick, and perhaps he afterward admitted just a little bit because she was named Sasaki, Dr. Sasaki put her on a mat in a semi-private room, which at that time had only 8 people in it. He wanted to set a fracture and put her leg in a cast, but he had run out of plaster of Paris long since, so he just stretched her out on a mat and prescribed aspirin for a fever and glucose intravenously and diastase orally for her undernourishment, which he had not entered on a record, because everyone suffered from it. She exhibited only one of the queer symptoms so many of his patients were just then beginning to show, the spot hemorrhages.
Dr. Fuji was still pursued by bad luck, which was still connected with rivers. Now he was living in the summer house of Mr. Okuma in Fukuoka. This house clung to the steep banks of the Ota River. Here his injuries seemed to make good progress, and even began to treat refugees who came to him from the neighborhood, using medical supplies he had retrieved from a cache in the suburbs. He noticed in some of his patients a curious syndrome of symptoms that cropped out in the third and fourth weeks, but he was not able to do much more than swathe cuts and burns. Early in September, it began to rain steadily and heavily. The river rose. On September 17th, there came a cloudburst, and then a typhoon, and the waters rose higher and higher up the bank. Mr. Okuma and Dr. Fuji became alarmed and scrambled up the mountain to a peasant's house. After the storm, Dr. Fuji and Mr. Okuma went down to the river and found that the Okuma house had been washed away. Altogether away.
Because so many people were suddenly feeling sick, nearly a month after the atomic bomb was dropped, an unpleasant rumor began to move around and eventually made its way to the house in Kabe, where Mrs. Nakamura lay bald and ill. It was that the atomic bomb had deposited some sort of poison on Hiroshima, which would give off deadly emanations for 7 years. Nobody could go back there all that time. This especially upset Mrs. Nakamura, who remembered that in a moment of confusion on the morning of the explosion, she had literally sunk her entire means of livelihood, her Sankuko sewing machine, in the small cement water tank in front of what was left of her house. Now, no one would be able to go and fish it out. Up to that time, Mrs. Nakamura and her relatives had been quite resigned and passive about the moral issue of the atomic bomb. But this rumor suddenly aroused them to more hatred and resentment of America than they had felt all through the war.
Japanese physicists who knew a great deal about atomic fission, one of them owned a cyclotron, worried about lingering radiation at Hiroshima. In mid-August, they entered the city. The scientists determined that the exact center was a spot 150 yards south of the torii and a few yards southeast of the pile of ruins that had once been the Shima Hospital. The scientists noticed that the flash of the bomb had scorched certain types of building material and, in some places, left prints of the shadows that had been cast by its light. A few vague human silhouettes were found, and these gave rise to stories. One story told how a painter on a ladder was monumentalized in a kind of bas-relief on the stone facade of a bank building on which he was at work in the act of dipping his brush into his paint can. Another, how a man and his cart on the bridge near the Museum of Science and Industry, almost under the center of the explosion, were cast down in an embossed shadow which made it clear that the man was about to whip his horse. The scientists in early September made new measurements, and the highest radiation they found this time was 3.9 times the natural leak. Since radiation of at least 1,000 times the natural leak would be required to cause serious effects on the human body, the scientists announced that people could enter Hiroshima without any peril at all.
As soon as this reassurance reached the household in which Mrs. Nakamura was concealing herself, or at any rate within a short time after her hair had started growing back again, her whole family relaxed their extreme hatred of America, and Mrs. Nakamura sent her brother-in-law to look for the sewing machine. It was still submerged in the water tank, and when he brought it home, she saw, to her dismay, that it was all rusted and useless.
By the end of the first week in September, Father Kleinsorger was in bed at the novitiate with a fever of 102.2. And since he seemed to be getting worse, his colleagues decided to send him to the Catholic International Hospital in Tokyo with a message from a Kobe doctor to the Mother Superior of the International Hospital.
Think twice before you give this man blood transfusions, because with atomic bomb patients, we aren't at all sure that if you stick needles in them, they'll stop bleeding.
When Father Kleinsorge arrived at the hospital, he was terribly pale and very shaky. He complained that the bomb had upset his digestion and given him abdominal pains. His white blood count was 3,000. 5,000 to 7,000 is normal. He was seriously anemic, and his temperature was 104. A doctor who did not know much about these strange manifestations, Father Kleinsorge was one of a handful of atomic patients who had reached Tokyo, came to see him, and to the patient's face, he was most encouraging.
"You'll be out of here in 2 weeks,"
he said. But when the doctor got out in the corridor, he said to the Mother Superior,
"He'll die. All these bomb people die. You'll see. They go along for a couple of weeks, and then they die."
Father Kleinsorge neither died nor got up in a fortnight, despite the fact that the message from the Kobe doctor deprived him of transfusions, which would have been the most useful therapy of all. His fever and his digestive troubles cleared up fairly quickly. His white count went up for a while, but early in October it dropped again to 3,600. Then, in 10 days, it suddenly climbed above normal to 8,800, and it finally settled at 5,800. His ridiculous scratches puzzled everyone. For a few days, they would mend, and then, when he moved around, they would open up again.
Dr. Sasaki and his colleagues at the Red Cross Hospital watched the unprecedented disease unfold. It had, they decided, 3 stages. The first stage was the direct reaction to the bombardment of the body at the moment when the bomb went off by neutrons, beta particles, and gamma rays. It killed 95% of the people within half a mile of the center, and many thousands were further away. The rays simply destroyed body cells. The second stage set in 10 or 15 days after the bombing. Its first symptom was falling hair. Diarrhea and fever came next. 25 to 30 days after the explosion, the white blood cell count dropped sharply. The 2 key symptoms on which the doctors came to base their prognosis were fever and the lowered white corpuscle count. If fever remained steady and high, the patient's chances for survival were poor. A patient whose count fell below 1,000 had little hope of living. The third stage was the reaction that came when the body struggled to compensate for its ills. The duration of the disease varied depending on the patient's constitution and the amount of radiation he had received. Some victims recovered in a week. With others, the disease dragged on for months. Whatever its source, the disease had some baffling quirks. Not all the patients exhibited all the main symptoms. People who suffered flash burns were protected to a considerable extent from radiation sickness. Those who had lain quietly for days or even hours after the bombing were much less liable to get sick than those who had been active. Gray hair seldom fell out. And, as if nature were protecting man against his own ingenuity, the reproductive processes were affected. For a time, men became sterile. Women had miscarriages. Menstruation stopped.
For 10 days after the flood, Dr. Fuji lived in the peasant's house on a mountain above the Ota. Then he heard about a vacant private clinic in Kaitaichi, a suburb to the east of Hiroshima. He bought it at once, moved there, and hung out a sign inscribed in English in honor of his conquerors. M. Fuji, M.D., medical and venereal. Quite recovered from his wounds, he soon built up a strong practice, and he was delighted in the evenings to receive members of the occupying forces on whom he lavished whiskey and practiced English.
Giving Miss Sasaki a local anesthetic of procaine, Dr. Sasaki made an incision in her leg on October 23rd to drain the infection, which still lingered on 11 weeks after the injury. Her spirits fell low. Her leg had been so swollen and painful all along that the doctor had not even tried to set the fractures, and though an X-ray taken in November showed that the bones were mending, she could see under the sheet that her left leg was nearly 3 inches shorter than her right, and that her left foot was turning inward.
A new municipal government, set up under Allied military government direction, had gone to work at last in the city hall. Citizens who had recovered from various degrees of radiation sickness were coming back by the thousand, and the government set in motion all kinds of projects to put them to work rebuilding the city. Statistical workers gathered what figures they could on the effects of the bomb. As the months went by, the statisticians began to say that at least 100,000 people had lost their lives in the bombing.
Scientists swarmed into the city. They found that mica, at which the melting point is 900 degrees centigrade, had fused on granite gravestones 380 yards from the center, and that the surface of gray clay tiles of the type used in Hiroshima, whose melting point is 1,300 degrees centigrade, had dissolved at 600 yards. They concluded that the bomb's heat on the ground at the center must have been 6,000 degrees centigrade. General MacArthur's headquarters systematically censored all mention of the bomb in Japanese scientific publications. But soon the fruit of the scientists' calculations became common knowledge. Long before the American public had been told, most of the scientists and lots of non-scientists in Japan knew from the calculations of Japanese nuclear physicists that a uranium bomb had exploded at Hiroshima and a more powerful one of plutonium at Nagasaki. They also knew that, theoretically, one 10 times as powerful, or 20, could be developed. They estimated that even with the primitive bomb used at Hiroshima, it would require a shelter of concrete 50 inches thick to protect a human being entirely from radiation sickness. The scientists had these and other details, which remain subject to security in the United States, printed and mimeographed and bound into little books. Altogether, the Japanese scientists were somewhat amused at the efforts of their conquerors to keep security on atomic fission.
Late in February 1946, Miss Sasaki had been growing more and more depressed and morbid. She seemed little interested in living. Father Kleinsorge went to see her several times. On his first visit, he kept the conversation general, formal, and yet vaguely sympathetic, and did not mention religion. Miss Sasaki herself brought it up the second time he dropped in on her. Evidently, she had had some talks with a Catholic. If your God is so good and kind, how can he let people suffer like this? She made a gesture which took in her shrunken leg, the other patients in her room, and Hiroshima as a whole.
My child, man is not now in the condition God intended. He has fallen from grace through sin.
And he went on to explain all the reasons for everything.
A carpenter from Kabe was building a number of wooden shanties in Hiroshima, which he rented for 50 yen a month, about 50 cents at the fixed rate of exchange. Mrs. Nakamura had bonds and other wartime savings. When her hair had grown in enough for her to be presentable, she went to her bank in Hiroshima. A clerk there gave her her money, and she rented one of the carpenter's shacks. It was in Noboricho, near the site of her former house. And though its floor was dirt and it was dark inside, it was at least a home in Hiroshima. And she was no longer dependent on the charity of her in-laws. During the spring, she cleared away some nearby wreckage and planted a vegetable garden. She cooked with utensils and ate off plates she scavenged from the debris. Prices were high. By midsummer, Mrs. Nakamura's savings were gone. In June, she went to Father Kleinsorge for advice about how to get along. And in early August, she was still considering the two alternatives he suggested: taking work as a domestic for some of the Allied occupation forces, or borrowing from her relatives enough money, about 500 yen, or a bit more than $30, to repair her rusty sewing machine and resume the work of a seamstress.
Whether or not Father Kleinsorge's answers to Miss Sasaki's questions about life were final and absolute truths, she seemed quickly to draw physical strength from them. Dr. Sasaki noticed it and congratulated Father Kleinsorge. By April 15th, her temperature and white count were normal, and the infection in the wound was beginning to clear up. On the 20th, there was almost no pus, and for the first time, she jerked along a corridor on crutches. 5 days later, the wound had begun to heal, and on the last day of the month, she was discharged. During the early summer, she prepared herself for conversion to Catholicism. In that period, she had ups and downs. She knew she would always be a cripple. There was nothing for her to do except read and look out from her house on a hillside in Koi across the ruins of the city where her parents and brother died. She was nervous, and any sudden noise made her put her hands quickly to her throat. Her leg still hurt. She rubbed it often and patted it to console it.
It took 6 months for the Red Cross Hospital, and even longer for Dr. Sasaki to get back to normal. For the first 4 months, Dr. Sasaki was the only surgeon on the staff, and he almost never left the building. Then, gradually, he began to take an interest in his own life again. He got married in March. He gained back some of the weight he lost, but his appetite remained only fair. Before the bombing, he used to eat 4 rice balls at every meal, but a year after it, he could only manage 2. He felt tired all the time. "But I have to realize," he said, "that the whole community is tired."
A year after the bomb was dropped,
Miss Sasaki was a cripple.
Mrs. Nakamura was destitute.
Father Kleinsorge was back in the hospital.
Dr. Sasaki was not capable of the work he once could do.
Dr. Fuji had lost the 30-room hospital it took him many years to acquire and had no prospects of rebuilding it.
Mr. Tanimoto's church had been ruined, and he no longer had his exceptional vitality.
The lives of these 6 people, who were among the luckiest in Hiroshima, would never be the same.
What they thought of their experiences and of the use of the atomic bomb was, of course, not unanimous. One feeling they did seem to share, however, was a curious kind of elated community spirit, something like that of the Londoners after their Blitz, a pride in the way they and their fellow survivors had stood up to a dreadful ordeal. Just before the anniversary, Mr. Tanimoto wrote in a letter to an American some words which expressed this feeling.
What a heartbreaking scene this was the first night. About midnight, I landed on the riverbank. So many injured people lied on the ground that I made my way by striding over them, repeating, "Excuse me." I forwarded and carried a tub of water with me and gave a cup of water to each one of them. They raised their upper bodies slowly and accepted a cup of water with a bow and drank quietly and, spilling any remnant, gave back a cup with hearty expression of their thankfulness and said,
"I couldn't help my sister, who was buried under the house because I had to take care of my mother who got a deep wound on her eye, and our house soon set fire, and we hardly escaped. Look, I lost my home, my family, and at last myself bitterly injured. But now I have got in my mind to dedicate what I have and to complete the war for our country's sake."
Thus they pledged to me. Even women and children did the same. Being entirely tired, I lied down on the ground among them, but couldn't sleep at all. Next morning, I found many men and women dead, whom I gave water last night. But to my great surprise, I never heard anyone cried in disorder, even though they suffered in great agony. They died in silence, with no grudge, setting their teeth to bear it. All for the country. Dr. Y. Hiraiwa,
professor of Hiroshima University of Literature and Science, and one of my church members, was buried by the bomb under the two-storied house with his son, a student of Tokyo University. Both of them could not move an inch under tremendously heavy pressure, and the house already caught fire.
Father, we can do nothing except make our mind up to consecrate our lives for the country. Let us give bonsai to our emperor. Tenno Heika, bonsai! Bonsai! Bonsai!
Strange to say, I felt calm and bright and peaceful spirit in my heart when I chanted bonsai to Tenno. What a fortunate that we are Japanese. It was my first time I ever tasted such a beautiful spirit when I decided to die for our emperor.
Yes. People of Hiroshima died manly in the atomic bombing, believing it was for emperor's sake.
A surprising number of the people of Hiroshima remained more or less indifferent about the ethics of using the bomb. Possibly they were too terrified by it to want to think about it at all. Not many of them even bothered to find out much about what it was like. Mrs. Nakamura's conception of it, and awe of it, was typical.
The atom bomb is the size of a matchbox. The heat of it is 6,000 times that of the sun. It exploded in the air. There is some radium in it. I don't know just how it works, but when the radium is put together, it explodes.
As for the use of the bomb,
it was war, and we had to expect it. Shikataganai.
A Japanese phrase meaning it can't be helped. Oh, well, too bad. Many citizens of Hiroshima, however, continued to feel a hatred for Americans which nothing could possibly erase.
I see that they are holding a trial for war criminals in Tokyo just now. I think they ought to try the men who decided to use the bomb, and they should hang them all.
Father Kleinsorge and the other German Jesuit priests, who, as foreigners, could be expected to take a relatively detached view, often discussed the ethics of using the bomb. One of them, Father Seems, wrote in a report to the Holy See in Rome,
"Some of us consider the bomb in the same category as poison gas and were against its use on a civilian population. Others were of the opinion that in total war, as carried on in Japan, there was no difference between civilians and soldiers, and that the bomb itself was an effective force tending to end the bloodshed, warning Japan to surrender, and thus to avoid total destruction. It seems logical that he who supports total war in principle cannot complain of a war against civilians. The crux of the matter is whether total war in its present form is justifiable, even when it serves a just purpose. Does it not have material and spiritual evil as its consequences, which far exceed whatever good might result? When will our moralists give us a clear answer to this question?"
It would be impossible to say what horrors were embedded in the minds of the children who lived through the day of the bombing in Hiroshima. On the surface, their recollections months after the disaster were of an exhilarating adventure. Toshio Nakamura, who was 10 at the time of the bombing, was soon able to talk freely, even gaily, about the experience. And a few weeks before the anniversary, he wrote the following matter-of-fact essay for his teacher at Noboricho Primary School.
"The day before the bomb, I went for a swim. In the morning, I was eating peanuts. I saw a light. I was knocked to little sister's sleeping place. When we were saved, I could only see as far as the tram. My mother and I started to pack our things. The neighbors were walking around burned and bleeding. Hataya-san told me to run away with her. I said I wanted to wait for my mother. We went to the park. A whirlwind came. At night, a gas tank burned, and I saw the reflection in the river. We stayed in the park one night. Next day, I went to Taiko Bridge and met my girlfriends Kikuki and Murakami. They were looking for their mothers. But Kikuki's mother was wounded, and Murakami's mother, alas, was dead.
You have been listening to Hiroshima by John Hersey, adapted for radio by John Valentine. In the cast, you heard Ruby Dee and John Valentine as the narrators, Tyne Daly as Mrs. Nakamura, Daniel Benzali as Father Kleinsorge, Roscoe Lee Brown as Dr. Fuji, Tony Plana as Mr. Tanimoto, Jeannie Sakata as Ms. Sasaki, Michael Chinyamurundi as Dr. Sasaki, and the various Japanese voices were played by Chris Tashima and Esther K. Che. Sound design for this production was by Steve Barker, with remote facilities provided by BBAT Productions. The technical director was Mark Torres. Hiroshima was produced by Artists United, The Feminist Majority, and the Pacifica Radio Archives, and directed by Michael Clark Haney. Executive producers for Artists United, Robert Greenwald and Kate McArdle. Radio producer, Brian DeShazer. Music composed by Mark Snow. Special thanks to Susan Stone of KPFA 94.1 Berkeley, Susan Loenberg of LA Theater Works, Hope Burley, Simon von Grunigen, Karen Pomer, and the staffs of the Pacifica Radio Archives, the Feminist Majority, and Artists United. I'm Brian DeShazer for the Pacifica Radio Archives. Thank you for listening.